Kurt, welcome to the Commerce Talks podcast. Today it's B2B again. I just came back from the Shop Talks Europe conference, and it still feels like Shop Talks and the other big conferences are focusing still 100% on B2C. So very few manufacturers, very few challenges for manufacturers to be solved. In your LinkedIn profile, I can read you're the e-commerce evangelist for manufacturers. So you have to do your daily Shop Talks conference yourself with your customers. Can you introduce yourself a bit before we're diving into the core topics?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Alex. And before I get into that, I have to share what an absolute honor and privilege it is to be with you. You know, my respect and admiration for what you've done as a serial e-commerce entrepreneur is nothing short of amazing. So kudos to you for kind of leading the charge, helping small entrepreneurs, worldwide to capture this e-commerce opportunity. So great to be here. My company is B2Btail. Little play on words, instead of retail, it's B2Btail. So hopefully you might like that one. And so what my shtick is I do e-commerce training, workshops, webinars for manufacturers. And a lot of folks that are digital immigrants, you know, maybe they're Gen X or baby boomers is, a phrase that we use here in the States. And, a little bit resistant or newer to this whole digital transformation or e-commerce. And so we want to teach our manufacturers how to fish in those e-commerce waters. So we want to kind of teach them of how to figure this thing out. So that's my shtick.
But I read in your CV, you started your own e-commerce company like 1995, almost. That's like almost 30 years ago, it feels like. And you became like very successful. It was not a small business. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So, 1995, that means one thing only. It means that I'm an old dude. So, yeah. So in 1995, I had a wholesale business and I was struggling horribly. My accountant likes to say that I was the biggest train wreck that she had ever met. And just sheer out of desperation and running out of options. It was 1995. And if, I don't know if you're even old enough to remember those days. It was like, you had like these little CDs were going out to people's homes and 14.4 modem dial up. And I'm like, man, I'm just running out of options. Let me try this little e-commerce thing.
Big times of AOL.
AOL was
actually AOL owned 50% of the CD printing market back at this time.
Hey, vertical integration, right? So, you had Prodigy, Excite, Netscape. You had all sorts of, companies way back in the day. This is pre-Google. And so, yeah, the whole e-commerce thing. And what's fascinating, when you look at the whole scope. So, yeah, that was 27 years ago. But we are still in the infant stages of e-commerce. So, again, the companies that I'm working with, small manufacturers, custom manufacturers, where e-commerce is new and they feel like they're late to the game. They are absolutely not late to the game. This party is just starting. And so there's just tremendous opportunity with e-commerce. So yeah, so I had a wholesale business, converted into e-commerce, took me a long time. It was very stressful, very challenging. We finally, through the 2000s, anybody that was in e-commerce and survived the dot-com bubble in 99 and 2000, if you survived it, then all of a sudden, the saving grace was Google. When Google hit the scene, and then all of a sudden social media started hitting the scene, like, Facebook in 03 and Twitter and YouTube. And so we just embraced all those opportunities and had a nice run. We ended up on the Internet Retailer Top 1000 companies 3 years in a row. And I ended up selling that company. So yeah, it's been a great run.
And compared to what happened like 25 years, 30 years ago, the challenges today when it comes to starting a new online business, especially in B2B, are a bit different. And I saw some numbers. I think you're also sharing these numbers. We are talking about like 1.8 trillion or even bigger B2B market. Lots of those market might be already like digitized, whatever it means. Mm-hmm. So are there still many companies that are about to start and need some help starting stuff in B2B? Or do we have a market where only advanced players are playing the game?
The party's just starting, and again, I give credit to you and your partner, Boris, for having a vision to start your e-commerce company in 2014. A lot of players were already in the field. And so I just really respect and admire, your scrappiness as an entrepreneur to plunge in. So on the B2B side for manufacturers, I don't, you know, don't quote me or back me up on these stats. I think like e-commerce retail sales represent like 15% of the market, 15% of the retail market. Okay. If it doubles every year for like the next however many years, we're still only going to be like maybe what, 25%? You know what I'm saying? Like it's you know, just it's just such a small market. On the B2B side, I believe it's under 10%. So in the grand scheme of things, it is, you know, like if we looked at the stock market 100 and some years ago, or say 100 years from now, we're like, man, should I invest in the stock market? It's ugly right now. Da, 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 da. You know, if you just go in and you're just patient and you just stay, get involved and just time, you know, you're just blossoming, just being part of that wave. In e-commerce, you know, what I found with my e-commerce company, we were growing double digits every year. I know you're growing triple digits every year. God bless you. You know, we were growing double digits every year just being in e-commerce. By just being in e-commerce, you're growing at double digits. So it is absolutely not too late. We are just starting. And so anybody out there that's considering e-commerce, now's the time to get into it.
But what's different from my point of view compared to the 20 years ago, and I started late in the 90s understanding like e-commerce and online online marketing. So we had time actually to digest every new development. So we started with the desktop. Our biggest problem like 20 years ago was, does a website work in Internet Explorer and later than in Firefox? So that was the main challenge. There was no mobile around, there was no metaverse, there was no SEO, there was no first party cookie policy, third party, there was no Amazon advertising system.
Yeah.
Today, if you're entering the market also in B2B, it's like super complex. But the to be successful in that market and to be able to grow with the market, might be double digits or triple digits depending on the niche, you have to like really ramp and accelerate your learning curve very fast. So there is no time to learn because like every year there's like new technology coming on top. So how do you see B2B companies, and you're saying you're helping especially smaller B2B companies when they're starting this kind of journey, how do you help them to adapt? Because from their point of view, it feels like they need to hire 100 people in order to just get on par to get the basics right. Mm-hmm. That's not about like becoming a B2B e-commerce leader. How does it work?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, you and I have a mutual friend with Brian Beck. We were talking about him before. And, you know, he has a great book, Billion Dollar B2B E-Commerce. And so, you know, he deals with a lot of Fortune 500, larger companies that are, you know, they're literally selling six-figure, seven-figure SKUs, you know, right online. So, you know, from the world that I'm in, it's a lot of, my preach is a lot of custom manufacturers where they make a part, they make a unit, they make a component for somebody else. They're in the supply chain, maybe aerospace, auto, what, you know, food, whatever it might be, and they make a part or a component, and yet they feel left out of this e-commerce space. Well, where e-commerce represents for them is taking that customer service off of their sales department and putting it, and I know you guys do a great job with this, of, you know, say like repeat orders. You know, so now instead of like calling, you know, a high paid sales rep and tying up their time with just repeat orders, which is great and it's building that relationship, but now let's put that onus onto the website. So that first and foremost are putting those parts and components on the website, and most importantly for customer service and repeat orders. Now, the thing that, you know, anybody follows my webinars, workshops, training, so on and so forth, I am hugely, hugely bullish on configurators. That's like music to my ears. I know you guys are involved with configurators. So, you know, I was on a call with a gentleman who's super active with configurators, and we're like, you know, I struggle to find a manufacturer that shouldn't have a configurator and some component. And what that does is it allows a new customer come onto their website and they can build or create that widget, that product that they have right on their, you know, so instead of dropping in a drawing, waiting 2 or 3 weeks for a quote to come back, they now could build that part. And maybe it's not exact, but at least gets the conversation started. And so that's, hopefully that answered, that's where.
Yeah. But that's a very good example. And there I see like a big like disconnect to the B2C strategies that are sold and that are preached actually at shop talks conferences and similar conferences, because you said it already, it's usually a quote in B2B commerce. Mm-hmm. All the systems we've learned in B2C were always meant for a direct transaction. Mm-hmm. Like all the measurement tools were direct transaction. All the mm-hmm. advertising setups were like direct transaction. Try to get the customer for low click price to the website. Try to increase the conversion, and like with a couple of high baskets, you might be able to have a have an average new customer for a good margin out of the first basket, a margin higher than the advertising cost. Mm-hmm. Now it's very different. Now you are describing a customer who might come to a small B2B website, mm-hmm. who might see the configurator, and then he requests a quote. And he says, okay, I've configured this kind of product. I need this kind of product 500 times, mm-hmm. three locations over a time span of 12 months, mm-hmm. give me a quote, yep. which was a very manual process before, but all the tools that are available mm-hmm. until now are not made for this kind of process. What do you do?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, and I know, like, you know, if you go on your website, you guys are working with, like, you know, Toyota and Siemens and a lot of major players. Again, you know, let's think about that, you know, again, back to my, it's all about me, Alex, you know, just come back to me. So it's, you know, those 30, 40, 50 employee companies, right? And that's in here in the States, you know, and maybe it's the same in Germany. 75% of all manufacturers are 20 employees or less. Okay, it's probably, you know, and it might be 80% is like 50 and less. So these are small family businesses or, you know, legacy businesses or whatever, you know, whatever that looks like. So here, you know, perfect example, custom manufacturer, they manufacture a widget or a part. And so now, and I'm going to throw on my SEO hat, okay? So many custom manufacturer, I make circuit boards, I bend metal, I cut steel, you know, whatever it is that they do, they're very broad. And they're like, hey, anybody that needs metal bent, we can take care of. Or anybody that needs, you know, a circuit board, you know. But when you talk to them, it's really not the case. But unfortunately, they're widget experts. They're not really thinking marketing. One of our preaches that we love to say, favorite saying, as a matter of fact, I'm working on another book right now. We call it niche down till it hurts. Niche down till it hurts, and then we finish it till it hurts so good. And what I mean by that, if you are a CNC shop or a custom manufacturer, contract manufacturer, stay in your lane. Get laser focused, and the more focused you are, instead of trying to be everything to everybody, be something to a handful of folks, but be the best at that. That's where that configurator comes in. And then when you laser focus on, like, okay, I am a CNC shop for a very specific part in aerospace, or I make circuit boards for such and such, or I do wire cable assemblies for this. When I get very specific, now I can start attacking and start crushing it on SEO. I can start coming up on search. My pay-per-click strategies are much more effective. My LinkedIn and my social strategies are more effective. And then when they do land on that website, now because I'm not trying to be everything to everybody, I'm trying to build a handful of parts. And even if I'm not exactly there, I'm keeping that potential customer on my website. I'm keeping them engaged. And now when I go to that configurator, and I'm, you know, I'm super excited and eager to learn more about Spryker's, you know, configurator. What we're doing is we're having that customer is creating that part, and it's now creating web pages with that part. So now our customer is creating content for us, and on those web pages, we're optimizing those pages. So now our customers are really taking, our clients are taking full advantage of SEO value with that configurator. So there's just multiple wins with a configurator.
Yeah, but what you're describing, that sounds like me a bit like transformation management. So you're saying don't do it all. Don't try to serve all customers for all purposes, but please focus. And those companies like became successful because they somehow like started this way, like grew to like 40 people. Usually they don't have like a 5-year strategic plan ahead where they can exactly tell you what their go-to-market strategy in the next state, what's the next product line is. It's really kind of an opportunistic driven driven business. What is your experience here? You've doing this now for a couple of years. So what kind of growth rate change you see with customers that entered this e-commerce journey that really started to focus on a on a specific challenge or on a specific product versus customers that stayed very broad? Is there like the ones that focused like grew like 100% year on year, the others only like 10%? Can you say something like that?
Yeah, great question. So I unfortunately haven't experienced that triple digit growth at this juncture, but I'm going to come back to the contract manufacturer that, again, typically what was very stereotypical is, you know, 40, 50, 60% of their business would be with that one customer. if they're an auto, you know, it might be either they're dealing with one of the major auto manufacturers or somebody in that supply chain. If they're in aerospace, they're dealing directly with Boeing, or they're dealing somebody in the food chain to Boeing, you know. And so again, 50 or 60% of their business. So I've been since COVID, I've encountered a lot of I kind of like, I'm like a little bit of a fix it guy. So like, you know, if you're doing great, a lot of times those customers aren't coming to me. It's the folks that are coming that, you know, so in aerospace, they've been absolutely crushed in the past few years, especially with the Boeing tragedies with the past few years. And then when you combine COVID and flight travel plunged, you know, 90%. So a lot of the manufacturers in the aerospace were just absolutely decimated. So now, and again, one, two, three customers represent 50 or 60% of their business. By embracing and tackling this and going into this process and laser focus at what they're best at, they're absorbing. So it's hard to say, you know, that their business is growing because a lot of it went down. But now they're seeing either stabilizing, or they're seeing some nice double-digit growth because they're offsetting that big loss by
Yeah. Okay, got
embracing
it. Got it.
e-commerce.
That totally makes sense. The one argument I'm often hearing from those specialized B2B companies, and you've described it, you've described like the ideal customer journey. But if I were a B2B company owner, I would say, but Kurt, nobody is searching this specific part of this product online. You know, they know their vendors, they know who's doing a good quality, who's doing a bad quality, and the people that are on the purchasing side never ever would do this. At least that's an argument I've heard at B2B conferences now for 4 years. How do you counter this one?
Phenomenal question, man. Alex, you come with some good questions, dude. This is great. So I love that. I have multiple examples, and I'll narrow it down. So say, you know, back to our friend Brian Beck. So I have a number of clients there. You know, Brian's dealing with a lot of high-end components, parts, machinery. So I've had the blessing working with several companies that they're selling equipment that's in the $250,000, $500,000, up to like $20 million range. Okay, and so the thing is, for them to land one customer could be transformational. Just one customer. So what we do with our training is we take them through search, and we do a deep dive on keyword strategy and what have you. Okay. So I'll give you one example. So LED manufacturer. They're an LED manufacturer. If you Google LEDs, do you think they have competition? Absolutely. Amazon, you know, you name it. Everybody and their brother that sells an LED, they're coming up against. Well, we started doing a deep dive into their keyword strategy, and all of a sudden I discovered that they had some components that they sell within the LEDs that they have first page ranking on. And I'm like, hey guys, I go, check this out. Look at this, for you, like you're number three on this, and like all this different variation of this one particular keyword, they up and down, they're coming up on first page of Google, and they had no idea. And I'm like, hey, you know, is that a good keyword? Is that product a good fit for you? They're like, you're not going to believe this, Kurt. Our largest competitor just closed a year ago during COVID on that particular part. He pulls up a spreadsheet. He goes, I just sold 75,000 units to a brand new customer because of that part. I'm like, dude, if I was you, I would give everything I've got. If that's a good product line, if you've got supply chain, if you can support and supply that, because you can exploit it. And part of our training, we call it, why I love working with manufacturers, is we teach how do you dominate search. And there's when you stay laser, if I'm going to do like CNC metal fabrication, good luck. You're not going to come up on search. But if I do metal fabrication for turbine engines or something very specific, that's what they do. And that ideal customer out there is indeed searching that, or they're on LinkedIn searching it, or what have you. When you're preaching that consistently, they're gonna marry that ideal customer. They're gonna be the best in that lane instead of trying to be, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. When we try to be everything to everyone, we are nothing to no one. So that's why we
Okay,
just
then
really preach
I would
niche down.
argue that on the SEO side or advertising side, you have to wait for the customer. But there might be some smart salespeople or a sales department, field sales department from the B2B manufacturer that say, okay, what's my job in the future? Then like a good consultant would say, your job is like finding customers on LinkedIn, trying to create a campaign, maybe brand awareness campaign, maybe a best CNC manufacturer in Tennessee campaign, whatever it is, to raise awareness and therefore like getting more top of the funnel traffic for the website, which will also increase the signaling on the SEO side. Have you seen manufacturers, especially with this size, like 40, 50 people, being able to do this? Because we are doing this obviously as Spryker, and it's a hell of complicated environment today, not only on LinkedIn, but on other channels too. But I would do it because it makes sense. You can find customers on LinkedIn for a CNC manufacturer in Tennessee.
Absolutely. So great example, great analogy. One thing that we love to preach and teach is like, how do you create that strong referral network? Okay. So for kind of like we call our training edutainment. So we try to make it a lot of fun and like, you know, people don't want to be bored to death. So we have a lot of different trainers. I mentioned like Brian Beck's one of our speakers. We do a lot of webinars. And so we preach like there is no death by PowerPoint under any circumstance. So we try to make them really fun and we try to make them engaging. So when we're tracking that ideal customer, we call them soulmates. How do we track and identify soulmates, the ideal customer? Okay. And so what we do with that referral network, we call it that soulmate 100. So if I manufacture a lamp, I want to partner, buddy up, become best friends with who's the lampshade guy, who's the woman that's selling light bulbs, who any other accessories that's going to go around my lamp. If I'm a lamp manufacturer, I want to have like a nice network. So here's a great example. So I have a client, they're in forging. Okay. So they're in forging and then in a very specific portion of forging, but it's very, forging is very broad. So like we've been like really focused. As a matter of fact, I'm on a call with them a little after our call today. And so what we've done is we've niched down, we focus on the parts that they forge. Well, they're in auto space. They do a lot of parts and components for steering columns. So now what they're doing is they're getting aggressive on LinkedIn and they're partnering, aligning themselves with anybody else that's making those other parts within that steering column, because guess what? They're targeting the exact same folks. So they're trying to create a real strong referral network, number one. Number two, they're attacking those keywords on the specific parts of that steering column. So instead of just like broad forging and again, trying to be everything to everybody, they're trying to attack the very parts that they're the best at. So that's my answer to that.
Okay. And then maybe the last part of the podcast, what manufacturing is usually like an early indicator when it comes to recession or inflation development. And you're obviously talking to like hundreds of different companies in different spaces. Let's count out the COVID effect. Do you see within like the recent months where we have like this kind of tech stock crash, do you see an effect on the manufacturing market? So less orders, less volume, less demand?
From a tech standpoint, I personally have not witnessed that. I'm sure the same in Germany, you know, what labor shortage, supply chain disruption, having people show up to work, you know, that's been their, you know, keeping their employees safe. Those are their three top priorities right now. So, you know, as far as the tech, you know, again, you know, a lot of them are using Excel for spreadsheets or their CRM. You know, unfortunately, they're in, you know, God bless them, they're small. They just have limited resources, limited tools. They're not the most tech savvy. So I personally have not seen the tech side hitting my world. And again, like the manufacturers I work with are traditionally on a smaller side. So I have not witnessed that.
And then most likely there was the same discussion in the US like it was in Europe because of the supply chain issues with China during COVID. So many manufacturers in Europe said, okay, we need to have a much, much, much more diverse supply chain setup. So more stuff must come out of Europe or the US or wherever, just not one part of the world, which definitely should have a strong positive effect on lots of manufacturers. Have you seen that in the US or is this happening?
Yes, I absolutely have seen consistently where, there's a lot of manufacturers saying, boy, people are coming out of the woodwork. And as a matter of fact, what I'm hearing from a lot of manufacturers, they can't keep up with capacity. They just, you know, labor shortage, can't get folks on the floor, can't get, people in the shop, struggling to find engineers, that type of thing. And so, yeah, there's a lot of folks that are now, they're receiving a lot of RFQs, a lot of quotes where the companies that they previously haven't. So, you know, back to, you know, boy, are they doing a better job on SEO and pay-per-click strategies? Or is it a combination of the two? It's, you know, it's probably somewhere in the combination. So what are you seeing in Germany? Are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, there's definitely demand for much more manufacturing capacities. But anyway, the manufacturing capacities, even before the supply chain politics change, was was kind of short. Now you have like a couple of industries that are like super short. Battery production, for example, like electronic components production is short. But what we see is that the state and the governments in Europe definitely spend lots of money, try to insource some of these capacities again. I think it's a good time to get the kids out of the high school again and send them to a forger to learn how to do that. There might be a career there.
Absolutely, I agree wholeheartedly.
Then I saw also on your website you wrote in a book with the interesting title "Stop Being the Best Kept Secret: Manufacturing E-commerce Strategy." Who should read it?
Who should read it? Well, let's see. My mother, my sister read it, so they loved it. And I know you have a phenomenal book, it's challenging writing a book. So, you know, again, my sweet spot, I try to practice what I preach by niching down. So, you know, I target small manufacturers and, it's kind of a blueprint, if you will. A lot of what we just covered today, niching down, embracing e-commerce. Every custom manufacturer has a preparatory process. And again, when they, now I'm just being a little bit redundant, and when they're just so broadening, when they narrow it down, that's what I feel the magic can happen. So, the book resonates well with a small manufacturer just trying to figure out this whole e-commerce journey. And so that's who I'm really kind of preaching to.
Yeah. On LinkedIn, I have a motto, which is innovate or die. Maybe you can like adapt this kind of motto like for your customers, like niche and win. Stuff like this, because it's...
That's right. I love that. I love your innovate and die. And I've caught you on a couple of different podcasts, and I know that's a tagline of yours and for the company. And again, I absolutely love what you guys, what you're doing at the company with you and Boris. It's very inspiring. German engineering is, world-class, top-notch, and now you're bringing it to e-commerce. And so, yeah, I'm a huge German fan, man. My wife and I love Germany. One of our favorite cities on the planet is Berlin. I've got a bunch of books about Germany right up there on my bookshelf. So it's just such an honor and privilege to connect with you. This is great.
Nice. Thank you. You should see Hamburg. If you like Berlin, you will like Hamburg.
Now you're making me jealous because I have not been to Hamburg. And so now I got to get that on. It's on my bucket list. We'll have to make that a top priority. So absolutely.
Kurt, I hope that's going to work out. Maybe this year, next year, maybe we're going to meet in Nashville at our Excite conference there. It was a pleasure. Thank you for being on the Commerce Talks show.
Alex, thank you, and God bless for you guys. And so thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.